I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is Cape Up. 400 years, 90 writers, 2 editors, 1 book. 400 Souls, a community history of African America, 1619 to 2019, is a remarkable volume that tells the story of Black people in the United States from the perspectives of 90 writers who reflect the community's diversity of perspective and lived experience. And by doing so, 400 Souls fills in more of and adds to the complexity of the American portrait. The 2 editors I mentioned are Professors Ibram X. Kendi and Keisha N. Blaine. Professor Kendi is the founding director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research and author of How to Be an Anti-Racist. Professor Blaine teaches history at the University of Pittsburgh and is an editor for the Post's Made by History section. Hear more about their book and learn some of the forgotten history in this conversation recorded on February 12th, right now. Professor Blaine, since you've got the top box, I'm going to start with you. This is a different kind of history book, right? It's a history book where some of the 90 writers aren't even historians. Collectively, who are the writers and why are their voices so important?
So we asked an array of writers to contribute to the volume. And as you point out, so many of them are not professional historians. We asked journalists to contribute. We asked philosophers to contribute. We asked creative writers to contribute, as well as poets. And what we wanted to do was really grapple with 400 years of history. And not, you know, we really didn't want it to feel like a typical history book. And of course, asking 90 historians would have, I think, taken away from the sort of, you know, tone that we were trying to set, which was bringing together a diverse community, which meant people coming to the history, writing about the history from their own, you know, experiences, but also from their unique trainings, whether in the field of journalism or in the field of law. And so it was important for us to create something new, something special, something original. And that meant bringing in writers from a wide array of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kendi, Professor Blaine just talked about the fact that you have poets in the book, and you write, quote, "Sometimes history is best captured by poets." Flesh that out some more.
Well, if there's anything I've learned in my time writing history, that is that it's deeply complex, that it's a variegated story, that in many ways we have to imagine things that we don't have, or speculate on decisions that we don't have specific evidence for, that we have to stretch the archive, especially when writing on peoples, particularly working class Americans and certainly working class Black folks who haven't left an archive, who haven't left speeches and necessarily written records. And so, you know, poets have the capacity to really show the depth and complexity and the imagination and the creativity, you know, of humanity. And so when that comes to bear on history, you know, I think they were really able at the end of each section to really flesh out and contextualize, you know, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. When I was in school, Professor Blaine, and we're going way back, like the 1970s, 1980s, Black history, the way we're talking about it today, just wasn't taught. Slavery was a chapter and not exactly told, honestly. The accomplishments of Black Americans were diminished if they were even acknowledged. So has anything changed since the 70s and 80s? And what needs to change?
So I think some things have changed. You know, when you look at how history textbooks are written, we're certainly at a place where the textbooks that are produced today or even in the last 10 years, I think are better than the ones that were published maybe 20 years ago. That does not mean that we still don't have work to do. In fact, we have a lot of work to do, especially I think in the last 2 or 3 years, we've been talking about textbooks in places, states like Texas, for example, where there's still a debate about how you talk about the Civil War and how you talk about slavery. And, you know, like you, I certainly, you know, encountered textbooks that didn't really flesh out the nuance and, you know, and even the trauma of the experience of slavery, and oftentimes glossed over it, or perhaps had a little box to, you know, focus on Martin Luther King Jr., but other than that, not really center key historical figures. And so a lot has changed, and part of that change is directly tied, I think, to the work of professional historians. You know, we've been working very hard to excavate the history in order to help people better write about the history in a way that reflects the richness and the complexity and diversity of the Black experience, but particularly in a way that centers Black agency, which is key. That Black voices appear, that Black ideas appear in these textbooks. Still some work to do, but I think we're making progress. And I think 400 Souls is certainly the kind of text that will help us move forward in that direction.
You know, what's interesting is that when people register to come to Washington Post live events, we give them an opportunity to, is there a question that you would like to ask? And what's interesting is that we got a lot of questions from people, more than I think we anticipated, asking about, you know, teaching this in schools. And here's a sample question. It says, how can schools from elementary to high schools do a better job in teaching the history of race in this country? Professor Kendi.
Well, first, I think that our schools have to recognize that we live in a multiracial, multicultural nation, and that we have to teach the cultures and the histories of many different peoples from their perspectives. And so I think if schools start from that standpoint and then start looking for literature that allows them to teach the history of Black folks and the history of other folks, I think they'll find that literature, and they'll certainly find it in 400 Souls. And one of the things we were very focused on doing with this book is, even though we have 80 writers, each of whom wrote 5 years of African-American history, each of their pieces are quite short. And so they're really bite-sized, and that allows a teacher in high school and even middle school to assign that single essay and build a whole section around it, or certainly a whole class.
And that's what I found. So my journalism training started at the New York Daily News, where you don't have a whole lot of space to explain complex issues. And so it's a skill to be able to write that short and so powerfully. And this gives me an opportunity now to dive into the book and start with the very first chapter that was written by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's the Pulitzer Prize winning creator of the Pulitzer Prize winning 1619 Project at the New York Times, and really sets the tone with that opening essay. We all know about the Mayflower, which landed in Massachusetts in 1620. But most people, myself included, didn't know about the ship named the White Lion, which landed a year earlier in Virginia in 1619. And in writing about how each ship has been treated in our national consciousness, Hannah-Jones writes, quote, "When we are creating a shared history, what we remember is just as revelatory as what we forget." 400 Souls is about revealing the forgotten or unknown or unheralded, isn't it, Professor Blaine?
It is. And it's funny that you you know, bring up Nicole's really remarkable essay, because I was even reflecting on my own experience as someone who had taken all of these history courses. And I don't think the first time I heard about the White Lion had to have been in college. So we're talking about at the moment that I'm pursuing a bachelor's in history, that I find out about the White Lion. And I thought to myself, well, you know, what about the person who doesn't major in history? And I was, of course, intentionally taking courses in African-American history, Africana studies. So I encountered this kind of narrative. But another student could have gone through 4 years of college, could have even gone on to pursue a master's, who knows, maybe even a PhD, and never encountered the story of the white lion. And I think that was a moment of reflection, certainly a painful one. And what is so powerful, I think, about the 1619 Project is, as you point out, it gets us to focus on this narrative that has been hidden, yet it's so crucial to shaping the American story. And so what does it tell us that we don't know collectively, or rather that we didn't know about the white lion until you know, the release of the 1619 Project? So it was important, I think, for us as editors, you know, we were discussing who will write that first essay, because that's the most important essay. And when the 1619 Project was published, we knew immediately that we had to reach out to Nicole to ask her to write this piece, because it truly, I think, connected so well with the larger goals of 400 Souls.
As she writes in that chapter, and so while arriving just a year apart, one ship and its people have been immortalized, the other completely erased. Professor Kendi, before I go to my next question, which is to you, I want to clear something up. Is it 90 writers or is it 80 writers?
So I would say 90 writers, because I don't want the poets to get on me and say that they're not writing. So we have basically, you know, 80 writers who are writing 5 years, and then 10 poets who wrote a poem in the text. So yeah, I'm sorry for that.
No, I just, look, we're a news organization. I want to get it right the first time. So here's another thing that comes up early in the book, obviously, and it's about whiteness and the power of whiteness. And they've been at the forefront of our current national conversation on race since the Black Lives Matter protests erupted again in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. But whiteness isn't just a concept, it's a legal construct. Ijeoma Oluo writes in her essay about the whipping of Hugh Davis, who was white. What did Hugh Davis do, excuse me, and how did the lashing of Davis establish whiteness, Professor Kendi?
Sure, so as Ijeoma writes in her piece, Hugh Davis in 1630 was punished for lying with a Black woman. And as she writes, it is a demonstration, really, for the first time in what became the United States, that whiteness was projected legally and certainly socially as pure. And so the idea was that this white man poisoned himself in a way by allowing himself to sleep with this unpure Black woman. And the reason why that is crucial today is not just because, as Ijeoma writes, that she's a biracial woman, but because of the purity of whiteness, she can't be half white, right? And so as a result, she identifies as Black. But also we have Americans today who imagine that they're losing their nation because Black folks, because Latinx folks, because other folks of color are arising in positions of power or even entering this country. In other words, the nation should be conceived of, they imagine, as purely white, and it's being defiled.
In-laws, love them or hate them, you're pretty much stuck with them. And when you're a ruler in the Middle Ages, that can be a serious problem. It might even land you dead. I'm Dan Jones, and on season 4 of This Is History, I'm telling the story of England's weirdest king, Henry III. He's in way over his head, and he's surrounded by bloodthirsty relatives with their eyes on his throne. To listen, search This Is History and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
And what's interesting, she writes, whiteness is a ledge you can only fall from. But she also makes this point. In 1630, when Hugh Davis was whipped, he's the white man who was punished for lying with a Black woman. But as she also writes, by 1640, when another white man was brought before Virginia law for impregnating a Black woman, it was the Black woman who was whipped while the white man was sentenced to church service. Again, more history, more complexity shown in not just the history of Black people in the United States, but the complexity of the history of the United States. You know, Professor Blaine, the book also recounts several revolts, slave revolts. There was the New York City Revolt of 1712, the Stono River Rebellion of 1739, and the Louisiana Rebellion of 1811. Herb Boyd writes in the chapter on the 1712 revolt, quote, "Time and again, white racism produced Black resistance. It is one of the longest running plot lines in African-American history. It has been and remains a self-perpetuating loop, doesn't it?"
Absolutely. And it's interesting because we were talking earlier about textbooks and the way that textbooks often tell the history of Black people in this country. And one of the things that we've seen in textbooks throughout the years is the way that some writers frame slavery and particularly the way that they suggest that, well, you know, enslaved people sort of figured out how to work within the system. And in the end, yes, slavery was bad, but not as bad, you know, not quite as terrible because all of these things came out of this institution. And it's really important, I think, for people to understand resistance, to understand that that enslaved people certainly fought for their freedom, that people were not simply going along with the system, even when it appeared that they were going along with the system. And you see that, I think, even in the instances you brought up, the Stono Rebellion and the plot to overturn a system. And in fact, the Stono Rebellion in particular is so, I think, critical because, as you point out, this is 1739. So this is before the founding, before the official, you know, before the U.S. Constitution, before what we mark as the beginning of the United States, and in those early years, what is clear is that enslaved people recognize whether other people see their humanity or not is not the point, but they understand their humanity. And they have dignity and they have respect for themselves and recognize that any sort of life devoid of freedom is simply not a life to have. And so they were constantly plotting and strategizing and resisting. And we see that throughout the course of history.
You know, one of the things that still comes up to this day when the issue of slavery comes up, there's always some politician or someone, someone white who says slavery wasn't that bad. They were happy. They had homes. They were clothed. They had food. They were taken care of. What? Please give a succinct pushback to that nonsense. Whoever wants to go first.
So slavery was maintained by awesome, persisting terror and violence. And that is why when you study these slave states, you have these multiple levels of military control to ensure that the enslaved people continued to work completely against their will, regular sort of violence, you know, and terror. And so you can't, to me, separate the institution of slavery from the institutionalization of terror and violence.
Mm-hmm. And I would just quickly add too, I mean, I mentioned humanity earlier. I think it's important for people to not forget that under the institution of slavery, that Black people were viewed as property, as things, you know, like a table, like a chair. I mean, it's so demeaning. And so when you talk about slavery, you can't simply say, oh, individuals were fed, individuals were clothed. Actually, people didn't even see them as humans. I mean, that is the crux of the matter. And so we can't tell this narrative in this flowery kind of way. It was a terrible institution and absolutely needed to have been dismantled. And Black people fought to ensure that it was dismantled.
You know, and that's the thing. The key thing you said there, Professor Blaine, that people should always remember is that during slavery, the slaves were not seen as human. They were seen at first and foremost as property. Let's talk about what's going on in the nation today, Professor Kendi. A common refrain in the aftermath of the insurrection, the January 6th insurrection, was this is not who we are, and that this was un-American. And you wrote, quote, this was a bald-faced denial, and quote, nothing has held back America more than its denial. Talk more about that.
Well, I think, you know, we spoke earlier about Nicole Hannah-Jones's opening piece in which she thought it was critical for the American people to not just learn about the Mayflower, which is considered the beginning of American freedom, but to also learn about the White Lion, which is the beginning of American slavery. And if you don't remember or are taught the White Lion, that means you possibly are not going to remember or be taught American slavery. So then in your mind, slavery is somehow outside of America. Then in your mind, white domestic terror is somehow outside of America. White supremacists engaging in coups are somehow outside of America. And so therefore, when you see what happened at the US Capitol, you're going to say, this is not who we are. But if you have learned about the White Lion, if you have learned about the Reconstruction era, where there was countless attempts, unsuccessful and successful, to overthrow violently democratically elected local governments throughout the South, then your response is, this is part of us. It's not all of America, but it's certainly part of America. And like with anything else, if we don't recognize it as part of us, how are we going to surgically remove it and become whole and healthy?
You know, Professor Blaine, I would love to get your view on that. The folks who are saying, this is not who we are.
You know, as Ibram points out, I just find it to be a sort of funny sort of thing, because in the end, anyone who studies American history understand that what took place at the Capitol in January is very much part of a longer history and a longer pattern. And you can draw those connections, I think, even in the recent past. You know, I've immediately thought about, Charlottesville, and I thought about the Unite to the Right rally. There's so many connections to be made between that development in 2017 and what took place at the Capitol. But as Ibram points out, we see a pattern of behavior historically that every time, and I'll talk about it within the vein of Black history, every time there's Black progress, there is white backlash. So it's not a mystery as to why we went from a Black president to a president who espouses white nationalist ideas and white supremacist ideas, because we understand historically how the nation sort of responds to what is perceived as a threat to the majority every time people of color, in particular, make some sort of step forward, there is going to be a violent response. And so January 6th was inevitable. We knew this just looking at 4 years of the Trump presidency, certainly. But we knew this also looking at the broader history, as Ibram points out.
I love how you said that January 6th was inevitable. What I should not have been surprised, but what did surprise me and make me gasp was the photo and then the video of that man walking through the United States Capitol with a Confederate battle flag. And I'm just wondering how, as scholars and historians, how did that make you feel to see a symbol of sedition and what's the word I'm looking for? The word that comes to mind is traitor. But what did it say to you? How did it make you feel to see that symbol in the United States Capitol? Professor Kendi, you go first.
So when I think of the Confederacy, when I see the Confederate flag, all I can see is what Alexander Stevens, who was the vice president of the Confederate States of America in 1862, what he said in what he called the corner, or what's been called the cornerstone speech, which essentially determined, really highlighted what this new nation, as they called themselves, was founded on. And in his speech, he said, Alexander Stevens, that this new Confederacy will be based on the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, and that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. And so that's what I saw. You know, I saw racist ideas walking through the US Capitol. I saw the permanence of the enslavement of me and my ancestors walking through the US Capitol on that day.
Professor Blaine, I mean, it's hard to believe that we have already almost gone 30 minutes and at the end of this. So I want to end with you and something you wrote in your closing essay. You write, "Are we our ancestors' dreams? Are Black people in the United States now living the lives our ancestors of the past imagined for us? I am not sure." Tell us why you're not sure.
Well, you know, as I wrote the conclusion, I wanted to both reflect on everything that Black people have accomplished in the United States. And of course, we're looking at 400 years. And I think it's important to acknowledge the gains, to acknowledge the triumphs. But what was clear to me was that we, despite all of our gains, are not in a place where we can truly say we have full freedom. And I imagine that my ancestors wanted full freedom for me, not half freedom, but full freedom. And what do I mean? The freedom to live my life out, you know, as I desire, as I please, the freedom to be able to walk the streets and not have someone look at me, make assumptions because of the color of my skin, not have an encounter with the police that could result in the loss of my life, you know, for some assumption that someone makes yeah. about me. And I just thought about police violence. I thought about, you know, COVID-19, the way it has been devastating Black and brown communities. I thought about so many challenges that we're still dealing with. And I just had to say, you know, yes, we've accomplished many things. I've accomplished many things as an individual. I think collectively, Black people have accomplished a lot. But it's hard to say that we're living our best lives. And when you look at educational inequality, when you look at, you know, incarceration rates, and the list goes on. So I thought it was important to remind people, yes, we've made progress. We can celebrate that, but we can't just celebrate. We actually have to continue doing the work because there's a lot of work left to do.
Professor Kendi, I'll give you the last word. Are we our ancestors' dreams?
I think we certainly don't live in a nation that our ancestors were dreaming about. But I would say that people like Professor Blaine, the 90 contributors in this text, you, Jonathan, other Americans, certainly Black Americans, who are advocating for an equitable and just nation, you know, a nation where we truly have a multicultural, multiracial democracy, where everyone is valued equally, where everyone is treated as if they're worthy and humane. I think that our ancestors are happy that people are advocating and pushing for that type of nation. But certainly we haven't, as Professor Blaine stated, arrived yet.
We are out of time, which is sad because there's so much more to talk about. Professor Keisha N. Blaine, Professor Ibram X. Kendi, thank you very much for coming to Washington Post Live. Congratulations on this important book, this important anthology. I'm going to figure out a way we can talk again for a little bit longer. Thank you very much for coming to Washington Post Live.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
There's always more to the story. I'm Leanne Caldwell, anchor of Washington Post Live. Each week, we bring you inside conversations between the newsroom and the people we cover. From global leaders enacting change to cutting-edge artists redefining our culture. And we make you and your questions part of every conversation. Listen to Washington Post Live wherever you get your podcasts and watch on demand at washingtonpostlive.com.